I guess everyone knows Zhao Zhang, Zhang Shao from Fudan University.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I would like to bring up this, I think, issue that about the Kajiwara experiment in which using the spin current to excite this spin waves in Higgs insulator. I guess most of you have already been very familiar with this experiment. Just briefly to introduce for those who didn't remember, is that in a Higgs film, which is this gray film, which is millimeter size, and on top of it, there were two platinum films, and in one of them is driving a charge current, and the other is detecting the voltage output. So it's insulating, so they are electrically, we believe it's electrically separated. And this charge current, if we look from the side, this is what the typical people believe was happening here, that you have a charge current running in this direction into the board, so basically this arrow here, and due to the spin hole effect, the spin current is generated, which is polarized in this direction, and then the spin current exert torque, excites spin waves here, and spin waves propagate, and in here, the spin wave precession here is non-locally detected by this second platinum in which the spin wave pumps spin current, and the spin current convert back into inverse spin hole effect. And then that's the voltage signal picked up in the second platinum. And this is their typical, this voltage output versus the input charge current. So this is the charge current in the left platinum, and this is the voltage output in the second platinum. There will be a threshold behavior, so there's a threshold here, and if the current reverse directions, which correspond here, there will be no voltage output as you see here. So this is a kind of Diode effect, and also you have some threshold effect, which is kind of consistent with the picture here, because you need the threshold to excite spin waves, and also if you change the direction of current, the spin current polarization is reverse direction, which will not be able to excite spin waves. So qualitatively it fits in picture, but what's the problem is that this threshold current, which is about less than 10 to the 9th ampere per square meter, which believed to be extremely small if you consider the spin hole angle, because you really need to time this spin hole angle to calculate the spin current. So this is the charge current on here. Spin hole angle is typically less than 10%. And so this charge current is believed to be extremely small. And also, the other day I talked to Sebastian that this is nanovolts output. So it's extremely tiny voltage output as well. And okay, he thought this very clean curve is probably, I'm not sure if... yeah, probably it's not the how far is from raw data is not clear.
Well, the status curve is also what Jos commented during the conference. Also, from the status curves, always seem to be surprisingly smooth.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. We can drill
in various contexts. It's because Japanese like a nice aesthetics, you know.
Mm-hmm. We can drill in about that in a few minutes, right?
Yeah.
When is it
going?
When was it exactly? I forgot.
3 weeks from now, give or take 1 week.
So in October?
Late October, early November.
Okay, so this is basically the experiment. Let's say we believe in the experiment, and okay, let's just adjust the theoretical
so
issue.
Far we haven't heard a lot of believing.
Yeah, so...
Wishful thinking. Everybody wants this to just work out, but...
Okay, so the main part would be this part, how to excite the spin wave, and what's the threshold to excite the spin wave. And detection part is relatively clear. So then this is just this bilayer structure, platinum and Higgs, and then theoretically what we are doing here is that okay, so we have charge current. We are going to solve the spin accumulation in the platinum layer considering the interface boundary condition at here, in which the spin current vanishes, and here the spin current would be continuous. I mean, the conduction electron spin current and the magnetic spin current to be continuous at this interface. And this interface, the magnetic spin current will be vanishing. And also, we consider the spin pumping due to the spin wave excitation into the plastron. So this also modifies the simulation. And we also take into account the dipolar effects that the dipolar spin waves are considered here. And basically, you're solving the spin diffusion equation in the platinum and the Lambda-Lifshitz-Gilbert equation in the EEG and match them in the interface. We also, in the linear response region, that the transverse magnetization will be small. And then we are looking for the eigenfrequency. And in as a function of the wave vector of the spin wave and also as a function of the inject current. Because this injection of current modify mu, which modify the imagined part of the spin wave dispersion.
Is this mu spin dependent?
Mu, this mu?
Yeah.
how to say? It's x dependent.
That's not a spin diffusion, that's spin.
Spin accumulation
is
usually spin
dependent. Yeah. That's what I asked. That's what the mu was, okay. That's the splitting, that's the spin accumulation.
Yeah. Okay, so we didn't consider the mu interdiffusion in this lateral direction. Okay, so we only consider diffusion in this direction. Because,
simple question. Mu is the splitting, the spin accumulation.
Okay, so let me just demonstrate the typical results that, so we are looking at the wave vector which is perpendicular to magnetization. So magnetization is this direction, then Q is that direction. And this is the dispersion that we have the bulk bands that just corresponding to the standing waves in the thickness direction. And the curve up is the exchange spin wave part, and the horizontal part is dipolar spin wave part. And so this is the spin wave profiles. So this is the X, which is the thickness. The film thickness is D, and this is the standing wave part. And this band is the magnetostatic surface spin wave, and due to the dipolar interaction. So if you look at this mode, at this Q, so it's profiled like this. It is a surface spin wave, okay, because it's exponential decay, but decay length is extremely long, inversely proportional to the wave vector. So it is, although it's a surface wave, but it's indeed like more like a bulk uniform mode. Okay, if you go to larger Q.
So this is, how is that possible? Because this is the Damon-Eschbach mode, right?
Yes, yes.
So that means they, on both sides of the film,
yeah,
they go in opposite directions.
Yeah, so you, if you
understand if you let them overlap strongly.
So if you there is another mode which just I mean the mirror reverse this too. Okay.
This is still far away or not?
No. The other mode would just swap.
Just overlap.
Yeah, the overlap.
No,
yeah, you can say that. I mean, all of these waves, you can see. Okay, this is also overlapping. So there will be actually this. So if you look at a larger Q here, actually they will interact. So a larger
is that one that looks like they have this avoided crossing in that sense?
Yeah, around here, this region. Yeah, they are kind of avoider. So this dashed curve is ignoring the interactions. So which can be calculated theoretically, analytically. And the real one is that they kind of if no interaction, they will just this surface wave will go like this, and the bulk wave will go like this. But with the interaction, they kind of end up crossing each other. And so a larger Q is typically look like this, which is mostly the bulk band. Bulk modes are all still the standing waves, and this mode is kind of hybridized with the bulk modes. The surface mode hybridized with bulk mode, which has the surface-like feature and also oscillating bulk-like feature.
But anti-crossing is just a finite size effect, finite thickness effect, right? The non-interacting That's what I wanted to ask. What do you, which kind of interaction would it be that would give rise to the avoided crossing?
So here is we have exchange and a dipole-dipole interaction included.
Okay.
So yeah, if you don't have dipole-dipole, then this band is not there. This band, yeah. And so this is we consider two different type of surface anisotropies. So in this way, in this case, there is no surface anisotropy. And now let's say we have okay. So let's say, if we only have this, we can also calculate a number for the threshold current, because you can, in the next slide, let's see.
Sorry, can I ask?
Yeah.
So how about the splitting and the anti-crossing? Like, how does it scale with the thickness?
The scale with thickness? I don't know, actually. I don't think this splitting is so crucial in here. It's a linearized Landau-Lefschetz-Gilbert equation with dipole-dipole interaction.
You don't, these are not eigenmodes.
They are
eigenmodes. They are
eigenmodes.
So, but you don't diagonalize
Hamiltonian. No. Yeah, this is a classical. Yeah.
This LG equation.
Yeah, LG equation and the dipolar fields and LG equation plus Maxwell equation.
You can write as what?
So
like sort of a Helmholtz equation. You linearize
it,
then
you
get a basic
equation. Yeah, okay, so this is no surface anisotropy, and this is just the figure we just talked about, and then this part is the imaginary part of the eigenfrequency, which characterizes the excitation, screen wave excitation information. In which we have run in this current density, in the platinum. So I mean, if you don't have current, then all the imaginary power will be positive, which is basically alpha times omega. I mean, for corresponding modes. Okay. So if you have spin current running, then it creates an anti-damping, and also we have spin pumping as well. So the interface mixing contacts enhanced damping will also be in there, and then there are some modes become negative damping, and that means that these modes are excited. And particularly if you look at this mode, it is this green mode here. Okay. So
that's what do you mean by speed bumping here? Speed bumping backflow from the excitations
into the
platinum.
Okay. Yes. So it basically enhanced damping. So you need to a little bit more current to compensate that. So if there is no spin pumping, that current will be smaller.
Isn't that a second effect? Because I mean, you're injecting the spin current.
No, this is not a second effect. It's basically.
No, but what I'm asking, uh-huh. My question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you know, you're riding the current through the platinum. The platinum is injecting the spin current, exciting with that spin current the magnetizations.
Perfect.
And this magnetization that oscillates feeds back
mm-hmm.
another portion as a damping.
Yeah.
To me, that's a second effect.
Okay,
it is
second order effect for the platinum part.
Yes,
but it's the leading for the eke part. So it's because the spin pumping.
I mean, it's self-consistent calculation in a way, but okay.
But because the spin pumping, no matter how small is the angle, the precession angle, the spin pumping is proportional to that angle, and also the damping. Intrinsic damping, Gilbert damping, is also proportional to that angle. So for the eke part, for the
intrinsic damping,
the Gilbert damping,
but
the alpha.
The Gilbert damping, not the one, the homogeneous
damping. Homogeneous damping. Yeah. So for the eke part, the spin pumping is the kind of the same order as the Gilbert
it's
damping.
So small because the alpha of g is so small.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe
so
that experiment is not so small.
Huh?
in that experiment, it's not so small.
The alpha is not so small in that experiment, but
yeah, same film. Or I don't think it's small.
So then this small. Would be a second.
Small.
Very small, also.
And from minus two or something.
For any other material, it would be
much, much
probably
better.
Negative.
What is the frequency of the moment that you excite?
Okay, so this is normalized with omega m. Omega m is like 4 pi ms, and here is about, I think it's about 10 or 20 gigahertz. So the eigenfrequency is about 10 to 20 gigahertz, or around that.
That's
10 to 30.
It's all the 4 pi ms.
Yeah. Okay, so this green mode here being excited first. And we believe that this is simply because that this, for the surface spin waves, the surface magnetization is big, so the torque effect is big. And also, the pumping effect will also be big. So the damping is increased the most, but the torque effect is also the largest. Yes?
When you say surface spin wave, how localized is this? What's the length scale?
Okay, so you can see here, this is x over the thickness, so it's about the thickness, this film we're taking like, how thick, is 0.6 micrometer. So D is about 0.6 micrometer here. And so this is about maybe 0.1 micrometer. The
thing. Thick.
Yeah, kind of thick. Okay, so this is for the case without the surface and anisotropy. And if we add the surface and anisotropy on the platinum-Ig interface, in which we are saying that the surface spins would like has a tendency to pointing normal. Has a tendency to point in normal, but it cannot point in normal because of the bulk exchange pool keeps it in plane, but it has a tendency to go to normal. And that what we call the easy axis surface anisotropy. And if we include that, the spectrums are mostly quite similar, but some of the gaps become bigger.
The parameter that you add, is this a phenomenological parameter, or are these measured?
Yeah, there are some discussion in 80s or 90s that in interface, even for free interface, there could be some sort of surface anisotropy. I mean, this surface anisotropy depends on how you cap the surface.
You extract that number from another experiment?
I quote some number. Some fun experiment paper that. This number is from some experimental paper.
It depends very strongly on the surface properties. For example, it could be very different if you cover it with platinum.
This is quoted from by itself.
No one has any idea what exactly the magnitude is, but every experimentalist agrees that such a surface and such exists.
Yeah, so one of the questions I will raise for the ab initio is to calculate for example, for free surface, what's the surface anisotropy? And that's.
You have some, that can say, or some this structure. But for this, if you put a metal on top, you don't know the structure.
Forget it.
But what? For this contact. There's no way to know it because it's not a mismatch.
Yeah, you have to somehow.
But the vacuum is easy.
So vacuum, you got a reconstruction of the surface, but maybe for this type of material, it's not so.
Okay, before we get on that, let's see what the result is.
Okay, so with surface anisotropy, the additional band comes out, which whose frequency at the zero wave vector would be smaller than all the frequencies. So and the profile is like this black curve.
What's the lowest frequency we can get?
Here, about.
And bigger than some.
Still, like 0.8 of the tens of gigahertz. So it's about.
Still.
Big.
Gigahertz.
Yeah. So okay. So this is the typical profile for the for the surface this new surface wave, and the penetration depth of the surface wave is inversely proportional to the strength of the surface anisotropy. If it's more strong, then this mode will be more localized at the surface. Okay. So this also will modify the modes at high Q, which also make them more localized at the surface. Okay. So the reason for this is because that we typically know that a surface type of waves has can be excited more with more easier. So with this surface anisotropy induced surface wave, we observe that it can be excited more easily. That we have the same running current here, but so here is zero. So you see this much more modes being excited and also excited more strongly because they dip into more negative regime. That means you need less charge current to excite this.
How much less?
Not so much.
He was precise in his statement.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you don't include spin pumping, then it could decrease by one order of magnitude. But if you self-consistently include the spin pumping there, it doesn't decrease that much. So this is the typical numbers from the calculation. That the blue dots are without surface anisotropy and the red dots are with spin pumping. So it decreases a little bit, but maybe a factor of two or so. But this is a log plot. The horizontal axis is the mixing conductance. The vertical axis is the threshold current for a particular mode, not the overall threshold, just a particular mode that, the solid curve is for the particular mode. The zero wave vector surface wave from the surface anisotropy. And the dots are from the real calculations. So the dots give you the real threshold current. Okay. So with blue dots are without surface anisotropy, and red dots are with surface anisotropy. And with surface anisotropy, we can calculate it analytically, which fits well. So it's differed by a factor of two or so.
Question.
Yeah.
So in the surface pumping, in the spin pumping, you need that essentially the metal states, the metallic, so non-magnetic metal states in contact with the surface to feel this parametric pumping of the boundary conditions.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
If on the other hand you did the experiment where you actually had, say, another metal that is not really, you generate a spin current. And then this other metal that's not strongly coupled, would you still have spin pumping flow back? Meaning that could it just be absorbed and then is the one generated platinum not affected as much?
I guess it's the spin torque and the spin pumping are reciprocal. So if one is smaller, the other is also smaller.
Yeah. So
I mean. You cannot have one and don't have the other.
You cannot get away from, if you're generating an effective spin torque absorbed from the spin current, you could always
have the similar spin pumping.
Stupid von Sager.
Yeah.
I have a similar question. So do you consider the processes measured non-local? But wouldn't you have also this backflow local? So isn't that automatically reflection of the magnons, so you have the incoming, the excited magnon incoming, but there must be also a backflow of magnons.
Yes, there will be.
And is that reducing your signal, or is it enhancing the signal, or what do you...
You're reducing the signal from the second platinum? Or?
Thinking is that you could have the same effect, the spin pumping effect also locally. It's not only after the transfer.
This is what we're talking about is the first
it's
part.
The first, okay.
It's the first part. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. So on the right figure is the spin wave this surface spin wave mode for different surface anisotropy. So this is just stronger the surface anisotropy, the more localized.
So why is it saturated
You mean this here?
This depends on the parameter. Or?
Yes. So this is basically in. I think this is mostly because of the spin combination in the platinum layer that it will saturate.
This is I guess more the spin pumping, right?
Which is this is the spin pumping.
Okay. Yeah. Spin pumping compensates.
So that higher currents don't help anymore.
Okay, so this is basically because that the larger the spin pumping, okay, you mean yeah, the mixing content, the larger the mixing content, the larger the pumping. Okay, so the spin pumping. So the surface mode actually it can experience larger torque. At the same time, it also give you larger spin pumping. So the spin pumping would enhance the damping for the surface mode much more than the bulk modes. So basically, the larger mixing contacts are helping increase in damping, or also helping increase in the torque effect. That kind of they are compensating each other, so you cannot reduce the threshold so efficiently.
Can I take the floor for 5 minutes?
No.
After that, right? Yeah, but as part of the discussion, because basically, I think it's all this detail, but I can basically recap all the story in back of the envelope calculation. Get to the number of 10 to 11, and I prove that you cannot get anything better than that. About that in 5 minutes.
Okay.
Just very again
another simple question. Uh-huh. I understood that the spin pumping effect is related to the spin mixing conductance at the interface.
Yeah.
What are the boundary conditions on the other side of your yield?
It's a zero.
No,
finite.
Nothing goes through.
Nothing goes through. Yeah, okay. And also no surface and attachment on the other side. Just free surface on the other
there
side.
There must be a reflection at the free surface as well.
No, so on the other side the magnetic spin current is zero.
Okay.
Yeah.
Of the yink.
Yeah, of the yink.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is quantum paramagnetic pumping, right? Essentially, the boundary conditions are changing with slow time of the vibrations that you excite, and that creates the flow, as far as I understand.
For them, this are not...
Which part of the 10 to the 11 that you want to tell us in 5 minutes?
For them, these are not stationary solutions.
So Yaroslav is sitting on hot coal, so...
Is she
of the copper, or what is the question?
No, it's all
No.
Yeah? Okay, just one more or two more slides. Okay. So okay, so let's just decompose the contribution to the damping or excitation. The intrinsic part, the spin torque part and spin pumping part. Of course, spin torque part and spin pumping part, they are quite similar because both of them are just proportional to the interface value of the magnetization because they are interface properties. So they are kind of opposite to each other, and also more stronger for the surface waves, which is understandable. And do I have more?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Okay.
The longer the better.
So.
For the future, guys. So our intention for the speech talks to be like 15 minutes or so.
Okay.
And it's supposed to initiate discussion rather than.
But on the other hand, there's been a lot of discussion here. This has been discussion. You know? I mean,
it's still sort of, I guess, 15 plus 15 sounds fair to me. We have still 2 minutes, so.
Right.
Okay, so this is the excitation power, I mean, sort of the excitation power, in which we change the surface anisotropy and also change the mixing conductance. Okay, so the surface anisotropy introduces surface anisotropy because it introduces additional surface wave band which can be easily excited, which reduces the threshold by order of two, but it increases the power quite a bit because you can excite a lot more moles than the original case. And because much more moles are being excited simultaneously, so it got much more power, which may be more than 10 times, or maybe. I mean, not 10 times, but 4. And if you change the mixing conductance from increase in the mixing conductance, you are shifting the power spectrum to lower frequency. This is simply because the spin pumping is frequency dependent. If it's a larger frequency, the larger spin pumping. And if you want to compensate the spin pumping, you need to have high current, or you can exciting the low frequency modes, which has less pumping. Okay. So this is basically what I'm suggesting. Okay, so we don't see how to explain the experiment, that two order of magnitude is still a gap between the threshold.
Two orders of magnitude.
Yeah, two. Okay. So the experiment is 10 to 9, and and what we can best is send to the 11. I'm sorry?
You need two orders of magnitude higher current.
Yeah. So my question is there any other physics? I think if the experiment is true, then there must be some other physics be missing.
Is the experiment done in the Tokyo lab or in the other lab?
Tohoku.
I know, but it was okay. So he moved, and there's a bit of difficulty
over after the move.
After the earthquake.
before.
Before the
earthquake. Okay, so I have one ingredient probably. I'm not sure if it is this platinum eager interface. How important is the spin orbital torque or in there? So this is my okay. So whatever you can.
Anyway, then we can also now explain that everything is.
By spin orbital torque require.
What is the
If you ignore, I think we have a previous calculation, probably the gap is like, instead of two order of magnitude, it's one order of magnitude.
You cannot ignore this.
But
it's also strange to me, you only have one parameter to decide everything. That means that, the activity of platinum already fixed the diffusion and spin
diffusion. Yeah, those are fixed.
Yeah.
Those are fixed.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
yeah, so
you find one thing. I'm asking a question about this. The spin torque. You mentioned the spin orbital torque.
The question is sort of, would Pong agree to have Yaroslav first or not?
Wait a second. This is a discussion. There's a talk. I have something for Lach to say.
Yeah.
You guys,
Yeah. If you have something to provide, yes.
Yeah. I think that's good. What this all about.
The spin of the torque itself will require a proximity effect of the platinum on the eagle, right? Yeah. It's not really big.
Right. This is
not a well question. I'm a little bit worried about the fact that spin mixing conductance is defined for the steady state, it's coherent transport, whereas all the other spin pumping
that is the adiabatic approximation, which is on the basis of
All right, guys. So, by the way, just to emphasize, this is not a seminar session. Okay, this is really, really a discussion. So,
It has been a discussion.
But now there's like, I have to ask, I have permission for the next speaker to speak. I mean, this is a discussion, so there's no permission that needs to bust. People volunteer and stand up.
Yeah, but you should not step on other people's.
Yeah, but come on, let me.
Look, he was so good for a week,
All right. So here's the thing, okay? Let's really boil down, the issues here. I need two experiments. I don't need any theories, like all this diffusion, whatever, spin mixing, all this stuff. I don't need it. I just need two experiments. One is a FMI experiment. I have a ferromagnet. I measure line widths in a thin ferromagnet, and that tells me, it's platinum. That tells me loss of spin current. By attaching platinum to the ferromagnet and measuring how line width changes, I know how much ferromagnet emits spin into platinum. And that, let's call that thing mixing conductance. It may or may not be, whatever that is.
How do you distinguish in this experiment what is intrinsic damping
and what is... By thickness dependence. So I'm assuming that there are two contributions to damping.
Listen, it's the inhomogeneous damping.
You have an interface, and if it's rough,
you're not going to be the inhomogeneous damping, you mean like, people have done that, right? People have distinguished all these contributions, the bulk inhomogeneous, Gilbert damping. That's not,
in particular
we're not
materials,
need,
but some materials
you have
may
to
not.
Do very careful frequency.
Yeah, very careful frequency dependence. We do all that, so we know how much goes out. I mean, people have done that. We wrote a review about that 10 years ago. It's all settled. Let's move on, guys. All right. So the second experiment, I'm sending charge current, and so this is this. Well, let's say this is
Heinrich type of experiments. He was really a pioneer in this sort of things, and the Japanese group also. And this is, let's say, this kind of Dehn-Ralph Miron type of experiment. I'm sending charge current, and I'm measuring torque. Again, very complicated. You know, you have to, you know, there are various approaches, double frequency generation, et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, we believe that you send charge current that somehow converts into a torque that, again, you know, there are ways to extract that. So those are the two experiments that I'm going to take, and the two numbers that I'm going to take from this experiment. Let's just say in quotation marks, the spin hole angle and the mixing conductance. The mixing conductance is describing the loss of angular momentum into platinum. So it's defined as follows. It's a h bar over 4 pi times the mixing conductance times omega, the frequency of this magnetic precession. And let's not do some vectorial parts of it. Let's not worry about that. And then the spin hole angle is defined as follows. That is the spin current that is absorbed by the ferromagnet in the presence of charge current flowing parallel to the interface. So the way the Cornell people define it, and let me use this definition, is as follows. The spin current, as you know, as a result of this, whatever spin hole, whatever Rush bar, whatever that process is at the interface, is defined as H bar over 2E, the spin hole angle, times the charge current. So these are the two experimental quantities I take into account. And these numbers are known, as we've heard, to be something like 10 to 19 per meter square for E, let's say, platinum. And this is of order 0.1. So let me just take those two numbers. Very clear, no questions asked. I have no spin diffusion lens, conductivity, nothing. So this is really, really, really unambiguous. I'm dealing with unambiguous quantities here, right? Loss of angular momentum by magnetic dynamics and creation, transfer of angular momentum by some kind of spin hole type of physics. Okay?
You don't need the cone angle here?
Yeah, so there's a cone angle here. Okay. So it kind of sticks out. Okay? Now, there are, of course, losses inside of the ferromagnet. In order, now come back to this Kajiwara experiment. In order to excite magnetic dynamics by current, I have to overcome some intrinsic damping, other problems that there are in homogeneous, whatever other, you know, whatever other degrees of freedom that I get excited. And I, you know, no matter what, I have to overcome this process. I have to overcome the spin pump. Okay? So let me neglect all the other losses except for spin pumping. So that would be the most idealized situation. That would give me the lowest threshold. So this is the lower bound for the current threshold. All right? And that would correspond to some kind of thin surface mode, perhaps, which is so thin that the bulk damping is unimportant. It's only that spin pumping that is left over. So in the most idealized situation, which would be realized for some surface mode, I have to take this torque and overcome this torque. And that's what sets the threshold for J. And you cannot get lower J. So if you put in numbers, you get J of 10 to 11 of ampere per meter squared. So that's basically my message. And there's nothing else one has to do to prove that the lower bound is 10 to 11 of amperes per meter squared. Let me just show you. So let's plug it in. Let's plug it in, play around. So here's what we get. So that's my main. That's the main result. And I'm not using any theory here whatsoever. I'm just using those two experimental facts. So that is the lower bound. J sub Q, that's the quantum of conductance, E squared over H. Again, you just play around with a little algebra here. And that's what you get. The units are correct, you can check. And let's plug in numbers. So in SI units, this is 10 to minus, the quantum of resistance is 10 kilo ohm. So this is 10 to minus 4. Mixing conductance is 10 to 19 divided by 0.1. For the frequency, let me take 3 gigahertz. So again, very conservative, very low frequency. That gives me 10 to minus 5 volt. You get 10 to 11 and because I'm using SI units, ampere per meter squared. So that's it. And you know, basically, there's no way to get lower than that.
One question. Is
yeah.
H omega, right, is governed by the
anisotropy. Yeah. Now H by omega. So I assume 3 gigahertz. If you can make make a mode with 30 megahertz or something.
I think you can make it very, very small because the most recent films from which Fadis uses, I think you almost don't see any hysteresis.
Well, in these films, you always have some gap. Magnets always have some gap. If you can make that gap.
Assume that you make this in-plane anisotropy zero. What happens to the magnet?
You always have dipole effects. You always have. I mean, if it's a surface mode, there will always be finite frequency for that gap. Typically, anyways, for this estimate, I took 3 gigahertz. Whatever your gap is.
I'm not sure you're right.
What?
I'm not sure you're right.
Look, all I'm saying is that if you take 3 gigahertz, that's what you get, which is typical for these films.
If you have a yink which has basic
then fine.
Zero in-plane anisotropy, will the dipole?
Hold on, what zero in-plane anisotropy? What do you mean by that? You always have straight anisotropy.
You can make it spherical. And assume that you can get this to zero.
I'm not saying more than I've said here on the board. If you can make omega less and less and less and less, you can lower the threshold.
You could say that indeed you can get a very
you could, that's all. That's why, look, that's why I was asking Jan, like, what the frequency is. As long as he's dealing with gigahertz frequencies, that's the number that you get. If you can design like, really, really nice films without any...
But I think
with one caveat. I'm assuming for simplicity, I'm assuming circular magnets here. So if you make really now, if you go to this kind of extreme elliptical magnets, you have to revise this analysis, and maybe there will be pre-factor there again that may hurt you. But so this is just for the kind of magnets that Jan described, for the kind of frequencies that he used, which I think are also the relevant frequencies for this experiment, because they also have fields.
The experiments also have
fields, right? Applied field. It's for some reason. So it's a field of order Tesla, or tens of Tesla. So anything that has to do with your theory or that experiment, you cannot get less than gigahertz. Now, if you take and if you start designing nice films with very low, low gaps, perhaps you can lower the threshold.
That's basically what you're asking the experimenters to do.
But in fact, I already, that's also this, this frequency, this gap is also bottleneck for our BEC type of things. And I was talking to experimentalists, I was asking them to sort of lower them. Somehow they always say there are some issues, because you start worrying about all kind of homogeneous broadenings. There are always some kind of intrinsic uncertainty about other things that you cannot, go to this really idealized situation.
Just a very, very fundamental question. Assume you have indeed zero in-plane crystalline anisotropy, but you do have, of course, always the dipole. Does this give you a gap or not?
No. Of course, if you have U1 symmetry, you're having a gap.
Then you really don't get a gap.
Yeah, but I would have to revise this estimate because then I would have to do it for this elliptical. These are ungapped magnets, but they're extremely, extremely elliptical. So then this analysis, I'd have to make a little bit. I would have, I would need two envelopes, but I would have to, it's very easy to, 5 minutes, 20 minutes.
Is there any
other
small processing
conductance that will help? Not really, because it would seem like it will help, right? But if you kill your mixing conductance, I'm sure you also kill this guy, whatever that is. Right? I mean, just put a tunnel barrier here, so you say, there's no mixing conductance, but there is also no spin hole angle. It's the ratio of the two. And this spin hole angle is a monstrous object that microscopically depends on also mixing conductance, on other things, But
this is a platinum property, right?
It's a property of platinum Yig interface. This is a property of platinum Yig interface.
The whole point of this, that you can have, if you have a proximity effect and things like that.
Of course.
That's going to be an effective.
It's all this proximity effect, everything is lumped into these two quantities. And we can talk about experiment theory, but experimentally, it's unambiguous quantities.
Yeah, but this is a completely unproven statement, right?
What?
That theta SH is associated to the interface.
Well, that's the experiment, right? You have an interface, you send current, you measure torque.
Yeah, but theta as h is something which is about property.
I don't know. I don't care. I don't care.
You have these measurements.
What?
I mean, you can separate the small angle of the body and the interface.
No, I don't want to do that.
You,
no.
In principle, you have
no, I don't want to do it because I don't want
to. This is not the real.
This is experiment. That's not the real spin hole angle. That's whatever. Unless I put quantize mark. But that's how experiment is done. They use this formula. And, you know, they send current and they measure torque. That's it.
So it cannot be a platinum tunneling. Because the different experiments with different geometries are giving different numbers. So if you tell me that this has nothing to do with the shear phase, I think it's totally
related to the resistivity of the plasma.
So well, also look, important. I don't know.
Don't say that it is.
That is directly, this quantity is directly experimentally measurable. The only implicit assumption in the story is that I'm assuming that everything happens at the interface. And that's essentially, if there's some kind of spin flip lens or spin relaxation lens, you know, like in platinum, it's a nanometer. That basically allows me to do it. I mean, I don't know exactly details of the physics at the interface, but I know everything happens essentially at the interface. All the torques are generated, et cetera. You know, it's all, you know, beyond one nanometer, that's over. It's over.
It's still a conjecture, which is not true.
Look, this is an experiment, right? So I don't know exactly. That's a conjecture. From that conjecture, I would say that if, as long as your platinum is thicker than a nanometer or so,
but Gary, what do you
then
mean?
There would be no thickness dependence.
I don't understand your point.
Because you get the same effect also for thicker layers of platinum.
All right, let's take a step back.
Yeah, but
this is experimental definition. This is experimental quantity. This is experimental quantity. You divide the two, you get this quantity.
I'm confused. But if it's independent of the thickness, would it be an
interface? It means it's an interface.
It's an interface effect.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the torque is an interface effect. Yeah. The spin current is.
This relation is most likely independent of thickness, beyond one nanometer or so.
Then it means it's an interface.
Yes.
Well, spin flip lens is a nanometer, so everything happens within that distance.
Is there a relation between the spin mixing conductance and the spin hole angle? Does
strictly speaking, no. There's no direct relation.
What I'm saying.
Microscopically, you know, in some.
It could be.
No, no.
Yes.
Of course, they're kind of related. So within microscopic theory, it was some kind of Bayesian diffusion equation.
Actually, this is not one physical property. They combine everything effective.
Yeah,
it's not defined as spin moment coupling, some interface.
You need
loss of a mixing of angular momentum.
Exactly, but now we're talking about theory.
Moment. The spin mixing conductance is, of course, defined in a spin polarized picture, in a two current model. Yeah. But you should modify it.
All right, guys.
To what extent is that useful anymore to call it spin conductance other than just going to the full matrix that defining your spin current characteristics, you know, then
let me emphasize again, I'm not using any theory, any two-spin model. That's why I put quotation marks.
Yeah.
Right? All I'm doing, I'm measuring line widths as a function of thickness, being very careful about, you know, all these other issues. And then I'm measuring torque in the presence of current. That's it. You know, I could be in the most extreme regime in which this two-spin channel model breaks down and everything. This is still, you know, these are two very unambiguous experiments which give you two quantities.
This system has the effect that you have some spin accumulation through the inverse thermodynamic effect.
Doesn't matter whatsoever, right? Because I'm not even within that nanometer. I don't even want to ask what's happening with that nanometer. So some crazy physics happens with that nanometer. Could be diffusion, could be Rajbe interaction. I don't know. I'm stepping away from that one nanometer. That one nanometer is my big fat interface, and that's it. And I'm conjecturing that as long as the film thickness is greater than one nanometer, there will be no thickness dependence whatsoever. But I don't even care if there's a thickness dependence. I mean, you know, then I can make the spin hole angle thickness dependent. I don't care.
You're just looking at what happens.
Right? But these are the two experiments which I think are unambiguous and are not relying on any theory.
Like what's absorbed and what's emitted?
What's absorbed and what's emitted, right? And you're measuring the spin current is measured from the point of view of the torque of the thermodynamic. And there should be no questions, right? I just put quotation marks because sort of, you know, the traditional people think of this as mixing conductance, and some people think of the spin hole angle. But then to get the number, I can get the number from an experiment. I can get the number from this mixing from experiment, but also Kesha showed that number actually agrees with
kind of some sort of simple-minded calculation for the spin mixing conductance.
Well, spin mixing is real.
10 to 19. So, rough, yeah, so then this one is actually pretty okay from the ab initio perspective.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah. This one is not okay. This one...
that's just an effective number
it's,
of...
Yeah, but...
Yeah, that's it.
Mixing that. Oh, you think it's an effector of 2?
Yeah, with an effector of 2 or
3,
that's fine.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah,
that's fine. So anyway, so that's... that's my message here.
Yeah, the 5 minutes are long gone, by the way, just so you know.
Well, you're asking questions.
But you see, for example, things like these surface modes, they are of course not
because you don't see them in the deck.
Yeah, I don't even care what mode that is. All I'm saying is that you have to overcome whatever that mode is. It could be some complicated mode. But in order to excite it, you have to overcome. You have to.
Yeah, but you don't see it in FMR, right? In FMR, if you are in FMR, you are in the bulk mode, right?
Look, this is a threshold, lower threshold, which doesn't rely on any assumption about what mode you have. I'm just looking at this, I'm balancing spin current at the interface. All I'm saying is that you have whatever you inject has to overcome whatever you emit.
Yeah.
And I don't care about the structure inside of that.
But it could be a completely different mode on the left side, which the experiment see, than what you see on the right side.
No. No. Okay, again, the point is, that's a relevant issue here. The point is as follows. Okay, we have to, of course, there is a certain assumption that this torque physics doesn't depend so much on the texture of your mode. So let's say whatever modes are sufficiently long wavelengths, such that the torque happens within, but in reality, this is always true, because this is an insulator, so the spin current only penetrates in a few angstroms into that insulator.
Yeah,
So the torque happens, the spin current, the torque happens right at the interface. So it doesn't matter what the models are, as long as you can extract this quantity.
Yeah, but the analysis to get this number depending on what mode you're talking about.
Yeah, this is supposed to be the same.
Well, the analysis, this is a torque due to current. How you measure it?
Yeah, basically, when you measure something, you need to trace down. Okay, what's the
distance? Sure, sure. Typically, the way it's measured in the Cornell group is you're looking at the dynamics of the mode of my mode, right? Of course, again, you're measuring the manifestation of the torque through some magnetic resistance, through whatever the dynamics does, right? But that's just a method of doing a good experiment. But it's not an issue. I mean, there's a certain number there at the interface that describes. That number does not depend on the mode anything. It's just a matter of extracting that number carefully in an experiment. But then you can look at whatever mode you want. That number is still one unique number that characterizes your interface.
Yeah, if you know which mode to use to analyze.
Look, I took this number to be 0.1, which is not going to be more than that.
It could be
0.1 was extracted. It's not going to be more than that. So I'm very, very conservative in this estimate. In reality, it's probably going to be less, which will drive this estimate.
It could still be that if you do the left experiments, you're doing FMR. If FMR does not see...
You can do these two experiments with two different modes. It doesn't matter. It's still fine.
If you have just a monolayer mode, for example, monolayer spins, you don't see it in FMR because it doesn't absorb. What you see is the bulk mode, which is huge.
Okay, I can get this number from Keshai and I'm happy.
But there are experiments with it tomorrow. So
I don't worry about the numbers so much. This is the more tricky one.
No, you're just this to say, no, I don't want any theory. We are just looking at the experiment.
But now you're becoming so picky. I mean, this number, you're really worrying about this number. Come on.
No, I simply said you have your own saga only.
I'm not using own saga here.
Yeah, but that can be completely different experiments.
Fine.
You cannot compare.
Fine, as long as the interface is the same. These are two interfacial coefficients. You can make all experiments you want. Could be completely different, on saga, unrelated. This is an interfacial property and that's it, period.
No, but you...
What's the question?
This is not an interface.
This is an interface effect.
The bulk magnetization.
I don't care. I'm looking at interfacial physics because on this side the spin flip lens is a nanometer. On the other side it's a tunnel barrier, so it's a few angstrom. So if I define my interface as like a region of a couple of meters around the normal interface, that's it.
Yeah, but you're
so these are two properties of that interface.
The effect of it, right?
Yes. Okay. Are you doubting that people have properly managed spin mixing conductance?
I think your statement is that you get very different results if there is a different anisotropy. If you couple to a different mode.
Doesn't matter. It's mixing conductance. Doesn't matter which mode you couple to. That's just a parameter. It's just a number of the interface. Doesn't matter what mode you couple to, unless your mode is like as a wavelength of an Armstrong.
Let's say for the left side it's not important, but for the right side, if you then couple to a special mode,
doesn't matter. You can do this experiment in one mode, extract this number. It's still relevant for this type of experiment.
I don't
see
that.
That is the spin current that is emitted by magnetic dynamics at the interface, no matter what the mode is. The spin current is given by the frequency of your dynamics and that parameter of the interface. Come on. I mean, I'm not using any Anti-Aggressive processes here.
I think you guys have to agree to disagree.
No, there's nothing.
Let the experimentalist sell.
All right. there's nothing to disagree here. This is done deal.
It's a Ukrainian done deal.
If you lower the frequency of the spin waves of the surface, you will use less current to.
Yeah. Oh, but then the experiment has a field of like a Tesla, or some fraction of a Tesla. Well, I told them. You know, they complained about something. I forgot the details. It's not the
detail. It's not a matter of detail.
We've been talking about this stuff for years now.
Yeah, I just want to.
Let's not worry about them.
Yeah, in the experiment, they assume that the spin current is carried by spin to the other gate, right? So the spin pumping effect should be reduced. Is it not toxic?
Well, here we just look at the generation and the left side of the experiment.
Most of the spin current is carried by the spin wave to the other. But you are assuming that the excitation all contribute to the spin pumping, right?
We haven't even excited anything. And to your comment, sketch bar experiment, you know, in this community for the last 3 years has been probably one of the most important experiments of many, many groups. The issue here that, you know, just trying to
validate.
Many groups, you know, in Japan, Europe, the US, tried to reproduce it. I'm sure they swept the field, they tried many, many things, and they could not reproduce it. So the issue here is how come they see it and nobody else can see, and according to theory, you can understand why, you know, it's very natural why nobody can see.
Kind of a bit of a problem with many of these experiments from this group. Reproducibility. Are we going to cite to is that something a site to could address or will say something about it?
I think we can.
Without recording him, I don't think you can. Record it, you know.
Everyone is allowed to not get the recordings or podcasts on the web. So that's always asked whether you get also asked for permission.
Okay.
So we have a warm discussion just now. So that's
that was the longest 5 minutes I ever witnessed.
Well, it was 5 minutes on my side.
Oh, we're gonna time it in that podcast. I'm gonna time how long you were talking.
These are the perks of being the boss, right?
So today I will present some result of angular and linear momentum in excited filament leads. See here, I mean. The excited filament means maglones or magnetic textures. So now we have already know that besides the conduction electron, maglone or spin wave can also carry spin current. For example, in a magnetic ferromagnetic rings, in the presence of inhomogeneous magnetic fields, so maglones can carry simultaneous or spin current. Also, the spin current can also be generated by some time-dependent magnetic fields. So the transport of maglone in magnetic, the transport of
Good.
Okay. So the transport of maglons in magnetic textures can induce the so-called magnetic spin transfer torque, and this effect has been observed in recent experiments. And Yaroslav has already given a very nice overview in his tutorial. Fortunately, he did not see everything, so it leaves me some room to present something else.
Probably I asked too many questions.
Yeah. So, the physics in this experiment and the Fourier series is about the conservation of spin angular momentum. But we know that in general, so not spin angular momentum itself is not a conserved quantity. So if we have other kind of interactions, we should take the orbital part into consideration. So although the agreement between experiment and the theory, so there are still other issues.
To be honest, even though it's our theory and also involved in experiment, my guess is the agreement is accidental. I would not push. I think it's a very complicated problem.
Okay, so let me just read some puzzles or issues.
It's good for public relations.
Okay, so in this simulation, besides, so according to the theory of magnetic spin transfer torque, if we pump a spin wave to the domain wall will move opposite to the spin wave, to the spin wave propagation. But in this simulation, they find the opposite effect. So besides the negative velocity, they also observe a positive velocity. It means that we send the spin wave, and then the spin wave will push the domain wall propagate forward.
What kind of simulation?
It's micromagnetic simulation. Yeah. So this is the simulation setup. Okay. And this here is the domain wall, and they localize a spin of source here, and then use a oscillating magnetic field to excite the spin wave, and then the spin will propagate But they observed the two seemingly opposite effects in their simulations. So one possible mechanism to explain the positive velocity is attributed to Ben Tartara's theory about linear momentum transfer in 9 years ago, I think. Yeah. But it's in the electronic system. In magnetic insulators, there are some complications. For example, there is a paradox about the definition of linear momentum in ferromagnets. So what's the proper definition of the linear momentum of ferromagnets? So this issue was first raised by Follwick, and there is a discussion about it by Hardin, and also Clement and Yaroslav has some hydrodynamics theories. And their theories explain the paradox by referring to the spin degree freedom of non-incoherent fermionic excitations. But this theory cannot apply to the magnetic insulators, because in insulators we do not have conduction electron, we do not have the fermionic excitations, we only have maglon or textures. So how to combine this together and to resolve the previous issues? So here's the outline of my talk. So I first give a brief introduction to the symmetry and the conservation laws, and then I will show my Hamiltonian, and then I will move to the discussion about the linear momentum and the angular momentum part. In the end, there are some conclusion and outlook. So the basic principle relating the symmetry and the conservation laws is attributed to a fantastic work of a German female mathematician, Emmy Noether. And her theory connects the symmetry and the conservation. For example, if we have a rotational symmetry, then we can obtain, or we can derive the angular momentum conservation equation. The same principle can apply to the translational symmetry. In magnetic system, for example, if we have a vortex and we have a domain wall, so this kind of two symmetries is preserved. So in this system, we can simultaneously have angular momentum conservation and linear momentum conservation. So here is the description and the Hamiltonian. So the in magnetics, the magnetization dynamic equation of magnetization M is described by this Lambda-Lifshitz equation. So here, H is the Hamiltonian, which includes the exchange interaction, the anisotropy, and the dipole-dipole interaction. So this is the dipole fields observe the obey the Maxwell equation in the magnetostatic approximation. So we based on the two coupled equations, we can give a unified description. So the which we can use the language of Lagrangian. So we can choose three canonical variables: the z component of the magnetization, the azimuthal angle of the magnetization phi, and there is a scalar potential. So which is defined the gradient of this potential is equal to the dipole field. So we can write we can use a standard procedure to write a Lagrangian density and write a Lagrangian equation. So
the variables usually come on pairs. So here on z and phi are paired, and what about psi? Canonical variables usually come in pairs, right? So that's
yes, yes.
So z and phi are collectively conjugate.
Yes, but because I hear that there's no such a but this equation can recover the all the previous equations, so Lambda-Lifshitz equation and Maxwell's equation and the magnetostatic case.
But one variable is redundant, right?
Psi is just the magnetostatic potential.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Psi
is the potential. Psi is potential. Yes. So we can use the Lotze theorem to derive the conservation law. So here is the example. Here, z also can be x and y. So I just write the one component here. So according to the standard theory, we can derive the definition of the momentum. So and then we can also obtain the, we can see that the total linear momentum is conserved. But we cannot, this expression is just formally is correct, but we cannot use it to the conservation between Maglons and the magnetic textures. The reason can be it can be easily see here that, for example, if we have a planar domain wall, whatever is linear or Borel wall, the phi, if within our common understanding, the phi is does not depend on the position phi. So it means that if we directly apply this formula to get the momentum carried by the domain wall, it is zero. But it's not the case because there are some ambiguity, some communication in this expression, because we know that at the two poles, north pole and the south pole, the phi is not a well-defined quantity. So we should find an alternative way to give the correct expression to the momentum of the magnetic system. So there's the similarity is shown here, but we can resolve it by so we can rewrite the linear momentum as a product between a vector potential A and the spatial derivative of M. And this can be rewrite as we can use the Stokes theorem to rewrite this integration, and then the singularity is removed.
Can you just change a gauge? Can you go to a different gauge, which is?
Isn't that equivalent to fixing your gauge?
That's what I thought. This is choose a gauge.
That's the step that you did. It's just
a no, it's not. It's gauge dependent. So we can see here. So, but we should because if we want to define the linear momentum, we should have a reference point. So reference means that, okay, we define here is the zero of the linear momentum. So here I choose the the path of L1. It means that this path.
That's what I'm saying, that you choose, you fix your gauge, you say, okay, start from here.
Yes.
And choose a gauge in which you don't have any of this problem.
But the difference between these two is gauge dependent. So we care about the change of the. But yeah, I think this line can be, you can arbitrarily choose, but so if you choose different reference point, you can get a different absolute value of the momentum. Mm-hmm. It's just like the Newton's references.
Yeah,
but the difference is gauge invariant, is a gauge invariant. So this means that, okay, if we simply choose, okay, the planar, or very simple, the simplest planar wall is represent the reference point of zero momentum, and then we can define, we can obtain the linear momentum of arbitrary magnetic textures. So here is the expression, and if we further assume this arbitrary domain structure is a simple planar wall, then the domain wall momentum can be found here.
Just a quick comment. So just okay. Connect to whatever those arguments of Holloway back then. I think in insulators, the other gauge-dependent piece of the momentum is carried by the lattice, physically.
But here we do not have lattice here,
yeah,
right?
Implicitly, so it's kind of there, you know. But,
yeah, but
you fix a Hamiltonian insulator to lattice. I'm saying it's okay, and there's some problems, but in principle, if you really want to dig into it, yeah, this is just a part of the linear momentum. The other part is contained by the lattice, but because you assume lattice is infinitely heavy,
mm-hmm.
You sort of don't care about it.
But I don't think we have lattice here, but we only care about the
you
momentum of a magnetic system.
Heavy.
We care about the momentum of a magnetic system.
Right, but physically, so, you know, what we showed is that there's linear momentum associated with magnetism, and there's linear momentum associated with electrons, kind of incoherent degrees of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't look at the electrons, it seems like there is some kind of gauge ambiguity. If you put them together, there's even absolute.
Yeah, but we must have the conservation of the linear momentum, right? If there is no lattice, if there is no electron, just a simple magnetic insulators. So
just physically speaking, what I'm saying is that since we, at the end of the day, there's still a full system for which the full linear momentum is a good quantity. What you're looking here is at the piece of that full system. The other piece is the lattice that you assumed infinitely had. Mm-hmm. In principle, you know, but then it's just a parenthetical comment.
Okay.
And then you continue on, and then because you assume the lattice is infinitely heavy, then it seems like you have some kind of ambiguity about the gauge, about the absolute value of the momentum. But in reality, it's not a problem for whatever you want to say, for the conservation laws and things like
okay.
that.
Okay. So because we only confine our system to the magnetic system, so we can discuss. We can use this linear momentum conservation law to study the spin wave interaction between domain walls. Okay, here is an example. So we have a block wall here, and we excite, we let a spin wave propagate or hit the domain wall. In a very general case, it will be reflected, and part of them will transmit. So according to the linear momentum conservation, this kind of reflection or the force due to the spin wave reflection must exert force on the domain wall. So,
so do you assume that your wall is, the width of the wall is comparable to the wavelength of the...
No, here I do not assume, I do not make any assumption.
But because the main wall is very smooth,
yeah, that's the calculation shown here. So it depends
on. It will not scatter, it will just be a particle.
But there isn't.
The scattering may be small.
Yeah, but
if it's not zero.
Yeah, but if it's very small, then
like
will also be scattering from lattice.
The question is, do you need scattering or not? Some small scattering?
Yes.
Or absorption.
What kind of?
Either scattering or absorption.
Yeah, do you need that or not?
I think the I do not have absorption, but scattering is a self-consistent calculated.
But you need scattering to get some non-zero transfer kind of
moment.
Yes, yes.
Some small reflection.
Yeah, it's not that, actually it's not that small.
Okay, it's not that small.
You know that
small.
Even
if you, the main wall
is... Yeah, I will...
Guess, like,
okay, the result, the calculation is showing in in figure C here.
The wavelength or your spin wave?
I have computed the full spectrum of the spin wavelength. So here is the. So we, for given zero temperature, is zero temperature. For given domain width delta, we fix the delta and tune the, we fix the domain width delta and fix the parallel component of the k of the spin wave, because this is not important. The important one is the perpendicular wave factor, right? So we can tune the k.
So you just calculated this as a function of k.
Yes, so we find that for non-wavelength case, so there is very strong reflection. It's very strong. So all, so it means that the spin wave is almost completely reflected by the wall. But for the short wavelength, the dipole-dipole interaction is not important. We go to the exchange energy dominates the scattering process. So the transmission is very large. So I think we think that this is a very different from the proposal, the work by you.
If the transmission is very large, then
the water is very large.
In that case, your effect will not be important, right?
Again, so
transmission is one, the matron just passes through the wall without interacting with it, right?
Yeah, I think that's I think it depends on in which region, because for the long wavelengths, for short wavelengths, the exchange interaction dominates, so there is no reflection. It's very weak.
Yes.
So it is very similar to the thermal magnetons as you discussed. But if the dipole-dipole interaction dominates the process, so in the long wavelength case,
long wavelengths compared to the main wavelength.
Yeah, I think it's the wavelength.
Yeah, it's for example, it's 0.1.
That's,
I think,
important.
It's.
Well, that's what we expect, right? That, yeah. That's just. I mean, Alex's theory is adiabatic theory. That's in the regime when the.
So in your adiabatic theory, so basically there is no reflection, right?
Yeah.
You do not assume that. So this in this region.
If you put in the number.
But in his, there is absorption. There is a damping.
Okay.
But
now there is a. But I think the Gibbs damping do not cause. Have a significant effect on the spin wave reflection or something.
It's
some absorption, but
it's back to this alpha beta discussion. The Gibbs damping gives rise to beta type of torques, adiabatic torques.
So in this case, I can
plug in like typical thermal magnetron wavelengths and typical domain wall waves. No wavelengths which are
artificially injected.
Yes, but he also cited Zhang's experiment from UCLA.
Yeah, but this is just a general introduction.
Okay.
This is only over injected wave.
Mm-hmm. What is the total force due to the spin waves?
Okay, the spin waves the force is we can see it from the minimum conservation, right? So this is the domain wall momentum. So we in previously we have phi. But the Musée angle. So this is the deviation of the domain wall momentum.
General, but
yes.
When you inject the spin wave, you have finite velocity of domain wall. This is your argument.
Yes, and this is the force. But still,
it's not a function of spin waves.
So I want to know how that expression.
I think that the way the spin wave momentum is just simply h bar k.
Yeah.
Right? So if the spin wave gets reflected by the wall, so for example from k to k prime, so there is a momentum change, and this momentum change should be exactly the same with the change of the domain momentum.
That means,
right?
If you integrate all the contribution from the reflected magnetron and calculate total momentum, you get the velocity, which agrees with that expression.
I think so, yeah. And so this is the force. So we can say that, okay, the spin wave reflection can only cause the rotation of the domain wall, but not a propagating of the wall.
Just to clarify. So Tatara worked on this kind of things for electronic system.
Yeah.
Right? Is that the same type of
talking
about? Just like linear momentum. So on the one hand, there's linear momentum of the main wall, and that's the same object?
I do not see any contradiction. Yeah.
So I guess that you use the same.
This is basically Newton's second law. Let's read that.
I understand the second law, but you basically also use the same logic, as texture, etc., etc.
It's a little bit different here because the linear momentum of the wall is not just linear movement of the wall.
So then there is difference with Tatarasan.
Yes.
So why don't you go back? So then Tatarasan has to revise his theory then?
I can read a very simple example to help you to understand. Why the domain momentum can be defined like this. Okay, so we assume a very simple, this is, for example, we have a cylindrical wire, we have a domain head, so this, and it's uniaxial. There is only uniaxial anisotropy. If we apply the magnetic field on it, so what's the effect? So the domain just rotates, but no propagation, right? If we neglect the Gibbs damping. So what's the role of the external field? If we apply the magnetic field along the wall structure, we can define the force on it, right? So this force, the effect of this force, only induce a rotation of the domain plane, not a propagation, right? So you can understand it from this way.
In fact, all this preceding discussion about the momentum of the domain wall is not really particularly important. What's important is that when you have magnons, they have momentum. And so
yes.
If you have magnons reflected, there is a force.
Well, my question is whether that force is domain wall.
No. That's exactly what it does. It applies a force to the domain wall. In the absence of Gilbert damping, it would simply rotate.
Yes.
In
the presence
of Gilbert damping, there is some motion.
My question is whether it's the same type of force that Tatarasan has discussed.
It's exactly the same. For the resolver, also the Schrödinger equation for the electrons around the domain wall, and calculate the transmission, and obtain the force.
So then you also need Gilbert damping for the domain wall to move?
In the absence of Gilbert damping, we have also, again, the same expression.
Without damping, it's conserved energy, so the wall cannot move. It can only spin in place.
So I think this is, what I did and what he did is, as a formal equivalent. Either it's conduction electron or spin rates, but the same physics.
The new effect here is that he's taking into account the force applied by a stream of magnons. That gets reflected.
The linear momentum gets, when it rotates, it just gets up. Transfer to an angular momentum of the rotation of the domain wall.
Forget about that. So there's a force pushing in the main wall.
Yeah.
Right? If there's some viscosity on the main wall, that's
and if it's not, the force will not.
It will always spin it.
It will just spin it.
Yeah.
It's the force creating the torque there. So that's what I'm asking.
This is sort of non adiabatic torque and. This gives you an effective field.
It's literally a force.
But that's still subject to
stress. If you apply magnetic field to the main wall, it's not going to move unless there is damping. Right? So it's exactly the same thing. The new ingredient here is a new kind of force.
Wow. Yeah. But again, it's still subject to projecting magnetic dynamics on these two collective variables. Right. Because in principle, if you extend your theory, it will move because it will emit spin rates, etc. So in principle, it will always move, right? I don't know. I mean, we had a talk from X-ray in Hong Kong who says that it would move pretty well just by spin rate emissions.
If you have an emission way of dumping energy somehow, if you have Cherenkov radiation of some sort, then it moves efficiently.
Yeah, but according to X-ray, you don't have any Cherenkov radiation.
But another question. Yeah, this spin wave is
scattering
on the potential of the domain wall, right?
Well, talk to X-ray.
Then it's second order in the derivative of the gesture, right?
Yes.
It's second order.
Right.
So in principle, if the texture is smooth, then it becomes even smaller.
Right. So it's very, if the wall is very sharp, it's very strong.
It's important that it's second order in the texture.
Yep.
If the domain wall has a finite width, then you would not only get this rotation, then you would
it has, because here is the delta is the domain width.
Delta?
Yeah, delta is the domain width. Here is a...
depends on the wavelength of your spin wave relative to the delta.
Delta, yeah.
And if it's you also second it's on. Like...
so you can always get long wavelength magnets, which will do the job, yeah.
So let's move to the angular momentum conservation. So following the similar process of knot theorem, we can arrive the conservation law about the angular momentum case. So because we have considered the anisotropy, so along the z-axis, so this the symmetry, the rotation symmetry is only valid around the z-axis. So only the z component of the angular momentum density and an angular momentum current present in this equation. So here I just show the expression of the angular momentum density. So the expression for the angular momentum current is extremely complicated, and you can find it in the article. So we can find that there are two terms generally. The first one is the spin angular momentum, as we discussed before. And the second one is the orbital angular momentum. So that's because this is simply a product between the position vector and the linear momentum, mz, and gradient of phi. So in this calculation, we can simply neglect the angular momentum carried by the EM wave, because according to the standard definition, the angular momentum current density of the electromagnetic wave is shown here. So because we use the magnetostatic approximation, so this electric component is ruled out. So we do not have to worry about this part. So as an illustration, we calculate a simple example. So we consider a uniform ferromagnet with spin wave excitations. And the previous formula gave us the expression of the total angular momentum as here. So here the m is the quantum number of orbital angular momentum, and 1 is the spin angular momentum. So this angular momentum carried by the spin wave is can be described or can be shown by the helical or vortex spin wave mode. So if m equal to 0, so the wavefront is like this. So if the orbital is m is not 0, so the wavefront is showing the vortex around the propagation direction. So it's interesting that in photonic and electronic case, so that this kind of vortex wave has been realized in experiment. So this is for the light, the electromagnetic field. And this is for the electron. So in their experiment, they used either spiral face plates or some computer-generated holograph to induce vortex electron wave package, which carries very high orbital angular momentum. For example, in this experiment, the orbital angular momentum carried by electron vortex electrons can be as high as 100 h-bar. So if we can inject a vortex type of spin wave to the cylindrical nylon wire and let it interact with the domain wall, so we know that if we inject the orbital angular momentum of the inject spin wave is n h bar, and after it transmitted through the domain wall in the center and in the other hand, so the orbital angular momentum can be changed to another quantum number n prime. So this, if the difference between these two is large enough, so we can achieve orbital angular momentum conversion to the spin part. And so this will be very efficient to drive domain motion. So that's the conclusion. Okay. Thank you very much.
How large can be the orbital momentum?
Yeah, but here I just give a argument, but it depends on the structure of the domain wall, right?
No, the domain wall, the spin wave, how large do you think you can make?
You mean, I think artificially or numerically you can do as large as you want, because it depends on the profile in the cross section. So if the cross section is if the diameter of the cross section of the wire is very large, so you can I think this n depends on the diameter of the cross section. So if the diameter is large enough, so you can make or you can produce a very large orbital angular momentum of spin.
That will be very hard to consider as well.
Yes.
Can you comment on the spin-orbit interaction?
Yeah, I think it's not the standard form of the spin-orbit interaction for electrons. Here, the spin-orbit interaction is simply the dipole-dipole interaction. Yeah, because
it should be Chelyushinsky-Moria.
Sorry?
It should be Chelyushinsky-Moria interaction.
Dipole-dipole also is about.
It's not a spin-orbit.
But you can,
dipole is not spin orbit, that's what I'm
saying. Yeah, but
it's pretty much the same as far as various consequences will be.
Well,
this is spin orbit interaction. I mean, that's
no spin orbit
interaction. It's a spin orbit in a way that.
Okay. So I think it's.
If you fix two moments and they interact by that interaction, you need torque to maintain the position.
I agree that they are related, but the consequences are not the same.
Okay.
There are many consequences which are of similar nature. Of course, they're not the same. There are many consequences of similar nature. You know, you could have anomalous thermal hall effect and things like that. Isaac Dilly, Jolashinsky, Maria, that whole interaction. So many consequences. And basically, I would say, almost, at least qualitatively, any consequence of one will probably have something similar.
But you're saying that if you have that polar interactions, that you're going to get very similar physics with Jolashinsky, Maria?
Well, you're going to have an anomalous effect.
You know, you're binding at some ends the directions of this magnetization, and therefore that's where you get the spin orbit device.
Tyler, let's spear him.
Huh?
Let's spear him.
No, I think, but there are proofs. Without Chelyushinsky Maria, you cannot explain several spin orbit.
There are certain things that Chelyushinsky Maria does.
There's different things, but it's two different types of. In many senses, there's two different types of spin orbit interactions.
No, I understand your statement so you said the dipole interactions in this case, if you fix the ends of your then that becomes an equivalent in this spin orbit coupling interaction.
I'm not sure. But
he says that you need some boundary conditions to really get a torque with this. Dipole-dipole interaction. You need to fix at some finite lengths.
Well, Ernst, let me talk to
it sounded like a profound statement that I didn't quite get. Okay, I'm very confused. As usual. Senior moment. We have lots of those.
Okay, thank you.
Good.
Okay, so are we ready?
Yep.
Okay, thank you. So, we have still 15 minutes.
We still have 15 minutes. Oh, crap.
Yeah, so if there is no one who wants, everyone wants to go to lunch, then of course we can sit.
No, only my question was not answered. But from what I've heard now, I mean, with this model calculations for magnons, you can get quite a lot of answers that you want. But so it's still, the question is still open. For which purpose would we need up initial magnons?
Right.
That's my
question. The long wavelength, we probably won't need that, right? We just want parameter, which is the spin wave thickness, and
my
everything
impression.
Is.
Yeah, the thermal effects. I'm interested in room temperature thermal phenomena.
But you need some magnon electron coupling as well, or what?
Magnon electron, magnon phonon, whatever couplings you have.
So what?
Whatever magnon is important for.
So we are really working on this relaxation times for magnon electron, magnon phonon.
Mm-hmm. But you calculate that by putting the imaginary part of this is the or in the spectrum part, similar to what he does, but trying to,
So how do we do that? So we really calculate the susceptibility.
Final momentum of frequency and then.
So you make a linear response.
Yes.
Yeah.
With the linear response theory, and then we do kind of the scattering cross sections. Since I want to put them into the corresponding Boltzmann equations, which is a different way than what you do. Since all what I have seen here, it's kind of a Landauer-Wüttiger for Magnus. His presentation. It's kind of a, just a propagation of magnets.
Yeah.
It's not really a scattering, so diffusive scattering of magnets. This is not included. And my question would be, for which type of experiments, or where do you think this kind of calculations could be important? Of course, for thermoelectrics, this is not what I know, but for the spintronics.
So do you calculate the electron self energy due to magnets?
Yes. And also,
I think important is sort of how much of energy transport is carried by magnons and how much by phonons. Can we calculate these things?
This is a little too early. I mean, we are a little further with the magnons than with the phonons. We don't have the phonon problem we have not yet solved, since it's a technical problem.
And you have time to maybe give a little to some Blackboard tutorial at some point of
the magnons.
Of just the techniques and then where you're at and what the challenges are. Mm-hmm. Could be useful.
Maybe it's I just.
This is Blackboard, not something you prepare.
I just wanted to have this input from you, since we are kind of at a very early stage. So
if you do mass structure, do you do you represent them in like ferment Riemann-Koch transformation, or
yes, I don't understand.
How do you construct the susceptibility?
When you do
so we have the green functions. We have the green functions in our code, and we can. So this is in particular work that was done in Halle by Pavel Buček, Arthur Ernst, and Leonid Zandratsky. And from the green function, we can really calculate the susceptibility. And from the susceptibility,
but you do Holstein Riemann-Koch kind of formula.
No, don't need that.
No.
It's not a localized model.
No.
You just assume that you have a magnetization, and then you define a linear response that.
But then how can you talk about magnon bands?
You have well-defined magnons at very low wave vector, but then they acquire a line width.
Yeah, you have a lifetime.
You have a small lifetime for a large.
Because, for example, there is a well-established band structure for magnons based on this Holstein-Primakov formula. Like in the
radio. So you don't have in metals. You don't have the damping by
like
stone excitation.
It's not for you what you're doing.
No.
Now it was done for iron and for cobalt, and the idea was particularly developed that the magnon dispersion relation was done for thin layers, and at the same time in Halle they did the measurements on the magnon dispersion for surfaces and synchrons. So this was until now the idea, but still we have this opportunity.
But again,
and so
the procedures that you have, the spin spaces, you calculate it from a homogeneous magnetization profile, then calculate the modes, and then you do the self-consistent tunneling where you put the modes in and then calculate it again.
For the symptoms and for the surfaces, we start really from the Green function of the
inhomogeneous
system.
What
would be
the
inhomogeneous? There's a semi infinite surface.
Inhomogeneous in the direction perpendicular to the layers, but in the layers they are homogeneous.
In the layer, of course, they are homogeneous, but we have this translational invariance broken perpendicular to the surface.
And then you put
and also
a spin wave in that direction, or what? I don't understand.
You have propagating modes along the layers, and you
and
have
standing
waves
perpendicular, as always. It's the same for electrons, and now.
And you see as many modes as the number of layers, unless the larger energy are so damp that you don't see them.
But then are they self-consistently put in back and forth, in essentially?
No, in principle, no. You it's linear response, so you calculate the low energy excitations above the ground at the ferromagnetic ground state.
Yeah.
So in principle, for transport, you could calculate the self energy, the electron self energy due to the magnons, and
yes,
see the effect of electron magnon scattering.
Which would be the.
This is
that
what
will,
we
will
are.
Give you the coupling, right? That will give you the electron.
We have just
that would give
calculated
you the electron,
this
electron
magnon
coupling.
Yeah.
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 But you could not do any phonon drag, for example.
This not within the next year, I would say. We are trying to in particular for this thermoelectric properties, we are trying to combine all of the three components, and then we would also have phonon drag practices.
This sounds like this is really long wavelength theory, right?
No. It's valid for all.
It's
independent of. It's not there.
If your treatment of magnetization, magnetic dynamics, it sounds like it's really long wavelength theory.
Why you say that?
No.
But if you go to room temperature, the wavelength is a few nanometers of this object, right? You're going to start, all this kind of atomistic effects will start playing a role if you're really serious about your band structure.
Right. This is exactly what we start from the atomic perspective. And everything is in, but you're right, and I agree, that for some questions, this is not at all important.
Yeah, thermoelectric questions.
Yes.
So when you're talking about this sort of combined thermoelectric theory, that sounds like it probably could be good in like Kelvin range, but not in room temperature range.
There is another point that is important.
The treatment of atomistic treatment of your magnetic.
The atomistic treatment becomes important for the thermoelectric as soon as you go from bulk systems to nanostructures. And so with layered structures, you get there is some hope that the figure of merit can be increased by an important factor. And so, and then this becomes important as soon as you have as you have films that are with a thickness of nanometers, then.
Yeah.
But I agree that for some questions, if you would treat the bulk properties, this atomistic treatment is not important. Yeah. But that's what we can, this is our way of doing things, and so we are interested.
So are you doing the same thing? So
she's doing that from DFT, as I understand. And what I do is that I have a multi-orbital type binding that we use parameters from DFT, but the results are very similar.
Yeah. So it's always good to have both. And we also try to do it on the type binding level and on the ab initio is not so fast.
Do you guys have the relativistic? Do you have the gaps for the spin waves and the
trials? I do.
We also have.
But you.
We didn't treat systems where this is important yet. At the moment, we concentrated to the films, the transition metal films, which have been investigated in the lab next door.
But like on iron on tungsten, for example.
This is what they did.
Yeah, as I remember.
This is Pavel Buček, is Leonid Zandratsky, Arthur Ernst, and the measurements have been done in Kirchner's department.
Yeah,
I'm not involved in this.
Okay.
No. Involved in this decoupling, where we do the electron phonon and the electron magnon coupling.
Yeah. So we'll need two more volunteers for next Friday. Just think about it.
So next Friday?
Next Friday we will have a similar, I think the planning now,
but I'm not anymore here next Friday.
You will not be here.
You cannot volunteer.
No. I leave on Friday morning to LA.
So hopefully somebody else will volunteer.
You
can do that. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah, okay, so other people can think, but also the juniors. The second row.
These juniors are here for the whole program, so we can always use them as the
No, I mean.
we have still some time, but
just keep it on. If anybody specifically wants to volunteer, and next week.